You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus, on edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Chapter 23 of Fathers and Sons. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Fathers and Sons by Ivan Turgenev. Translated by Richard Hare. Chapter 23. Having seen Arkady off with ironical sympathy, and given him to understand that he was not in the least deceived about the real objects of his journey, Bazarov shut himself up in solitude and set to work with feverish intensity. He no longer argued with Pavel Petrovich, particularly since the latter assumed in his presence an oppressively aristocratic manner and expressed his opinions more by inarticulate sounds than by words. Only on one occasion Pavel Petrovich fell into a controversy with the nihilist over the then much discussed question about the rights of the nobles in the Baltic provinces. But he quickly stopped himself, remarking with a chilly politeness, "However, we cannot understand one another. I, at least, have not the honor of understanding you."
"I should think not," exclaimed Bazarov. "A human being can understand everything, how the ether vibrates, and what's going on in the sun. But how another person can blow his nose differently from him, that he's incapable of understanding."
"What, is that a joke?" remarked Pavel Petrovich in a questioning tone, and walked away. However, he sometimes asked permission to be present at Bazarov's experiments, and once even placed his perfumed face, washed with the finest soap, over the microscope, in order to see how a transparent protozoan swallowed a green speck and busily chewed it with two very adroit organs which were in its throat. Nikolai Petrovich visited Bazarov much oftener than his brother. He would have come every day to learn, as he expressed it, if the worries of his farm had not kept him too busy. He did not interfere with the young research worker. He used to sit down in a corner of the room and watch attentively, occasionally permitting himself some discreet question. During dinner and supper, he used to try to turn the conversation to physics, geology, or chemistry, since all other subjects, even agriculture, to say nothing of politics, might lead, if not to collisions, at least to mutual dissatisfaction. Nikolai Petrovich guessed that his brother's dislike of Bazarov had not diminished. A minor incident, among many others, confirmed his surmise. Cholera began to break out in some places in the neighborhood,
and even carried off two people from Maryino itself. One night Pavel Petrovich had a rather severe attack of illness. He was in pain till the morning, but he never asked for Bazarov's help. When he met him the next day, in reply to his question why he had not sent for him, he answered, still very pale, but perfectly brushed and shaved, "Surely, I remember you said yourself you don't believe in medicine." So the days passed. Bazarov went on working obstinately and grimly, and meanwhile there was in Nikolai Petrovich's house one person to whom, if he did not open his heart, he was at least glad to talk. That person was Fenichka. He used to meet her chiefly in the early morning, in the garden or the farmyard. He never went to see her in her room, and she had only once come to his door to inquire, should she give Mitya his bath or not? She not only had confidence in him and was not afraid of him, she felt freer and more at ease with him than she did with Nikolai Petrovich himself. It is hard to say how this came about, perhaps because unconsciously she felt in Bazarov the absence of anything aristocratic, of all that superiority which at once attracts and overawes. In her eyes he was both an excellent doctor and a simple man. She attended to her baby in his presence without any embarrassment, and once, when she was suddenly overcome by giddiness and headache, she took a spoonful of medicine from his hands. When Nikolai Petrovich was there, she kept Bazarov somehow at a distance. She did this not out of hypocrisy, but from a definite sense of propriety. Of Pavel Petrovich she was more afraid than ever. For some time he had begun to watch her, and would suddenly appear, as if he had sprung out of the earth behind her back, in his English suit, with an impassive, vigilant face, and with his hands in his pockets. "It's like having cold water thrown over one," said Fenichka to Dunyasha, who sighed in response and thought of another heartless man. Bazarov, without the faintest suspicion of the fact, had become the cruel tyrant of her heart. Fenichka liked Bazarov, and he liked her also. His face was even transformed when he talked to her. It took on an open, kindly expression, and his habitual nonchalance was modified by a kind of jocular attentiveness. Fenichka was growing prettier every day. There is a period in the life of young women when they suddenly begin to expand and blossom like summer roses. Such a time had come for Fenichka. Everything contributed to it, even the June heat which was then at its height. Dressed in a light white dress, she seemed herself whiter and more graceful. The sun had not tanned her skin, but the heat, from which she could not protect herself, spread a slight flush over her cheeks and ears, and a gentle languor through her whole body, reflected in the dreamy expression of her charming eyes. She was almost unable to work, and kept on sighing and complaining with a comic helplessness. "You should go oftener to bathe," Nikolai Petrovich told her. He had arranged a large bathing-place covered with an awning in the only one of his ponds which had not yet completely dried up. "Oh, Nikolai Petrovich! But you die before you get to the pond, and on the way back you die again. You see, there's no shade in the garden." "That's true, there's no shade," said Nikolai Petrovich, wiping his forehead. One day, at 7 o'clock in the morning, Bazarov was returning from a walk and encountered Fenichka in the lilac arbor, which had long ceased to flower but was still thick with green leaves. She was sitting on the bench and had, as usual, thrown a white kerchief over her head. Beside her lay a whole heap of red and white roses, still wet with dew. He said good morning to her. "Oh, Evgeny Vasilich," she said, and lifted the edge of her kerchief a little in order to look at him, in doing which her arm was bared to the elbow.
"What are you doing here?" said Bazarov, sitting down beside her. "Are you making a bouquet?"
"Yes, for the table at lunch. Nikolai Petrovich likes it."
"But lunch is still a long way off. What a mass of flowers!"
"I gathered them now, for it will be hot later on, and one can't go out. Even now one can only just breathe. I feel quite weak from the heat. I'm quite afraid I may get ill."
"What an idea! Let me feel your pulse."
Bazarov took her hand, felt for the evenly throbbing pulse, but did not even start to count its beats.
"You'll live 100 years," he said, dropping her hand.
"Ah, God forbid!" she cried.
"But why? Don't you want a long life?"
"Well, but 100 years? We had an old woman of 85 near us, and what a martyr she was! Dirty, deaf, bent, always coughing, she was only a burden to herself. What kind of a life is that?"
"So it's better to be young."
"Well, isn't it?"
"But why is it better? Tell me."
"How can you ask why? Why, here am I. Now I'm young. I can do everything. Come and go and carry, and I don't need to ask anyone for anything. What can be better?"
"But it's all the same to me, whether I'm young or old."
"How do you mean, all the same? It's impossible what you say."
"Well, judge for yourself, Fedosya Nikolaevna. What good is my youth to me? I live alone, a solitary man."
"That always depends on you."
"It doesn't all depend on me. At least someone ought to take pity on me."
Fenichka looked sideways at Bazarov, but said nothing.
"What's that book you have?" she said, after a short pause.
"That? It's a scientific book, a difficult one."
"Are you still studying? Don't you find it dull? I should think you must know everything already."
"Evidently not everything. You try to read a little of it."
"But I don't understand a word of it. Is it Russian?" asked Fenichka, taking the heavily bound book in both hands. "How thick it is!"
"Yes, it's Russian."
"All the same, I shan't understand anything."
"Well, and I don't want you to understand it. I want to look at you while you're reading. When you read, the tip of your nose moves so nicely."
Fenichka, who had started to spell out in a low voice an article on creosote she had chanced upon, laughed and threw down the book. It slipped from the bench to the ground.
"I like it, too, when you laugh," remarked Bazarov.
"Oh, stop!"
"I like it when you talk. It's like a little brook babbling."
Fenichka turned her head away.
"What a one you are,"
she murmured, as she went on sorting out the flowers.
"And how can you like listening to me? You have talked with such clever ladies."
"Ah, Fedosya Nikolaevna, believe me, all the clever ladies in the world aren't worth your little elbow."
"There now, what will you invent next?"
whispered Fenichka, clasping her hands together.
Bazarov picked up the book from the ground. "That's a medical book. Why do you throw it away?"
"Medical?" repeated Fenichka, and turned round to him. "Do you know, ever since you gave me those drops, do you remember? Mitya has slept so well. I really don't know how to thank you. You are so good, really."
"But actually you have to pay doctors," said Bazarov with a smile. "Doctors, you know yourself, are grasping people."
Fenichka raised her eyes, which seemed still darker from the whitish reflection cast on the upper part of her face, and looked at Bazarov.
She did not know whether he was joking or not.
"If you want, we shall be very glad. I shall have to ask Nikolai Petrovitch."
"You think I want money?" interrupted Bazarov. "No, I don't want money from you."
"What then?" asked Fenichka.
"What?" repeated Bazarov. "Guess."
"As if I'm likely to guess."
"Well, I will tell you. I want one of those roses." Fenichka laughed again and even threw up her hands, so amused she was by Bazarov's request. She laughed, and at the same time she felt flattered. Bazarov was watching her intently.
"By all means," she said at length, and bending over the bench, she began to pick out some roses. "Which will you have, a red or a white one?"
"Red, and not too large."
She sat up again. "Here, take it," she said, but at once drew back her outstretched hand, and biting her lips, looked towards the entrance of the summer-house, and then listened.
"What is it?" asked Bazarov. "Nikolai Petrovitch?"
"No, he has gone to the fields. And I'm not afraid of him. But Pavel Petrovitch, I fancied."
"What?"
"It seemed to me he was passing by. No, it was no one. Take it." Fenichka gave Bazarov the rose.
"What makes you afraid of Pavel Petrovitch?"
"He always frightens me. One talks, and he says nothing but just looks knowing. Of course, you don't like him either. You remember you were always quarreling with him. I don't know what you quarreled about, but I can see you turning him this way and that."
Fenichka showed with her hands how, in her opinion, Bazarov turned Pavel Petrovitch round about. Bazarov smiled.
"And if he defeated me," he asked, "would you stand up for me?"
"How could I stand up for you? But no, one doesn't get the better of you."
"You think so? But I know a hand which, if it wanted to, could knock me down with one finger."
"What hand is that?"
"Why, don't you know, really?
Smell the wonderful scent of this rose you gave me." Fenichka stretched her little neck forward and put her face close to the flower. The kerchief slipped from her hair onto her shoulders, disclosing a soft mass of black, shining and slightly ruffled hair.
"Wait a moment. I want to smell it with you," said Bazarov.
He bent down and kissed her vigorously on her parted lips. She shuddered, pushed him back with both her hands on his breast, but pushed weakly so that he was able to renew and prolong his kiss. A dry cough made itself heard behind the lilac bushes. Fenichka instantly moved away to the other end of the bench. Pavel Petrovitch showed himself in the entrance, bowed slightly, muttered in a tone of sorrowful anger, "You are here?" and walked away. Fenichka at once gathered up all her roses and went out of the summer-house.
"That was wrong of you, Evgeny Vasilich," she whispered as she left.
There was a tone of sincere reproach in her whisper. Bazarov remembered another recent scene, and he felt both ashamed and contemptuously annoyed. But he shook his head at once, ironically congratulated himself on his formal assumption of the role of a Don Juan, and went back to his own room. Pavel Petrovitch went out of the garden and made his way with slow steps to the wood. He stayed there quite a long time, and when he returned to lunch, Nikolai Petrovitch inquired anxiously whether he felt unwell. His face had turned so dark.
"You know I sometimes suffer from bilious attacks," Pavel Petrovitch answered calmly.
End of chapter 23. Recording by Roger Moline.
Chapter 24 of Fathers and Sons. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Fathers and Sons by Ivan Turgenev. Translated by Richard Hare. Chapter 24. 2 hours later, he knocked at Bazarov's door.
"I must apologize for hindering you in your scientific researches," he began, seating himself in a chair by the window and leaning with both hands on a handsome walking stick with an ivory knob. He usually walked without a stick. "But I am obliged to ask you to spare me 5 minutes of your time, no more."
"All my time is at your disposal," answered Bazarov, whose face quickly changed its expression the moment Pavel Petrovich crossed the threshold.
5 minutes will be enough for me. I have come to put one question to you."
"A question? What about?"
"I will tell you, if you will be good enough to listen to me. At the beginning of your stay in my brother's house, before I had renounced the pleasure of conversing with you, I had occasion to hear your opinion on many subjects. But as far as I can remember, neither between us nor in my presence was the subject of single combats or dueling discussed. Allow me to hear, what are your views on that subject?"
Bazarov, who had stood up to meet Pavel Petrovich, sat down on the edge of the table and folded his arms.
"My view is," he said, "that from the theoretical point of view, dueling is absurd. But from the practical point of view, well, that's quite another matter." "So you mean to say, if I understand you rightly, that whatever theoretical views you may hold about dueling, you would, in practice, not allow yourself to be insulted without demanding satisfaction?" "You have guessed my meaning completely." "Very good. I am very glad to hear that from you. Your words release me from a state of uncertainty."
"Of indecision, do you mean?"
"That is all the same. I express myself in order to be understood. I am not a seminary rat. Your words have saved me from a rather grievous necessity. I have made up my mind to fight you."
Bazarov opened his eyes wide.
"Me?"
"Undoubtedly you."
"And what for, may I ask?" "I could explain the reason to you," began Pavel Petrovich, "but I prefer to keep silent about it. To my mind, your presence here is superfluous. I find you intolerable. I despise you. And if that is not enough for you..."
Pavel Petrovich's eyes flashed. Bazarov's, too, were glittering.
"Very good," he said. "Further explanations are unnecessary. You've taken it into your head to try out on me your chivalrous spirit. I could refuse you this pleasure, but it can't be helped."
"I am sensible of my obligations to you," answered Pavel Petrovich, "and I may count, then, on your accepting my challenge, without compelling me to resort to violent measures?"
"That means, speaking without metaphor, to the stick?" Bazarov remarked coolly.
"That is entirely correct. You have no need to insult me. Indeed, it would not be quite safe. You can remain a gentleman. I accept your challenge also, like a gentleman."
"Excellent," observed Pavel Petrovich, and put his stick down in the corner. "We will say a few words now about the conditions of our duel. But I should first like to know whether you consider it necessary to resort to the formality of a trifling dispute which might serve as a pretext for my challenge."
"No, it's better without formalities."
"I also think so. I suggest it is also inappropriate to dwell further on the real reason for our skirmish. We cannot endure one another. What more is necessary?"
"What more is necessary?" repeated Bazarov ironically.
"As regards the conditions of the duel itself, since we shall have no seconds, for where could we get them?" "Exactly,"
where could we get any? I therefore have the honor to put the following proposals to you. We shall fight early tomorrow morning, at 6, let us say, behind the plantation, with pistols, at a distance of 10 paces.
At 10 paces? That will do. We can still hate each other at that distance.
We could make it 8, remarked Pavel Petrovich.
We could. Why not?
We fire twice, and to be prepared for everything, let each put a letter in his pocket, accepting responsibility for his own end.
I don't quite agree with that, said Bazarov. It smacks too much of a French novel, a bit unreal.
Perhaps. You will agree, however, that it would be unpleasant to incur the suspicion of murder.
I agree. But there is a means of avoiding that painful accusation. We shall have no seconds, but we could have a witness.
And who, may I ask?
Why, Pyotr.
Which Pyotr?
Your brother's valet. He's a man standing at the height of contemporary culture, who would play his part in such an affair with all the necessary. Repeated Vasily Komilfo.
I think you are joking, sir.
Not in the least. If you think over my suggestion, you will be convinced that it is full of common sense and simplicity. Murder will out, but I can undertake to prepare Pyotr in a suitable manner and bring him to the field of battle.
You persist in joking, said Pavel Petrovich, getting up from his chair. But after the courteous readiness you have shown, I have no right to claim. So everything is arranged. By the way, I suppose you have no pistols.
How should I have pistols, Pavel Petrovich? I'm not an army man.
In that case, I offer you mine. You may rest assured that I have not shot with them for 5 years.
That's a very consoling piece of news.
Pavel Petrovich picked up his stick.
And now, my dear sir, it only remains for me to thank you and to leave you to your studies. I have the honor to take leave of you.
Until we have the pleasure of meeting again, my dear sir, said Bazarov, conducting his visitor to the door.
Pavel Petrovich went out. Bazarov remained standing for a moment in front of the door, then suddenly exclaimed,
"What the devil! How fine and how stupid! A pretty farce we've been acting, like trained dogs dancing on their hind legs. But it was out of the question to refuse. I really believe he would have struck me, and then—"
Bazarov turned pale at the very thought. All his pride stood up on end.
"I might have had to strangle him like a kitten."
He went back to his microscope, but his heart was beating fast, and the composure so essential for accurate observation had disappeared. "He saw us today," he thought, "but can it be that he would do all this on account of his brother? And how serious a matter is it, a kiss? There must be something else in it. Bah! Isn't he in love with her himself? Obviously he's in love. It's as clear as daylight. What a mess! Just think! It's a bad business," he decided at last. "It's bad from whatever angle one looks at it. In the first place, to risk a bullet through one's brain, and then, in any case, to go away from here. And what about Arkady? And that good-natured creature Nikolai Petrovich? It's a bad business."
The day passed in a peculiar calm and dullness. Fenichka gave no sign of life at all. She sat in her little room like a mouse in its hole. Nikolai Petrovich had a careworn look. He had just heard that his wheat crop on which he had set high hopes had begun to show signs of blight. Pavel Petrovich overwhelmed everyone, even Prokovich, with his icy politeness. Bazarov began a letter to his father, but tore it up and threw it under the table. "If I die," he thought, They will hear about it. But I shan't die. No, I shall struggle along in this world for a long time yet. He gave Pyotr an order to come to him on important business the next morning as soon as it was light. Pyotr imagined that Bazarov wanted to take him to Petersburg. Bazarov went to bed late, and all night long he was oppressed by discordant dreams. Madame Odintsov kept on appearing in them. Now she was his mother, and she was followed by a kitten with black whiskers. And this kitten was really Fenichka. Then Pavel Petrovich took the shape of a great forest, with which he had still to fight. Pyotr woke him at 4 o'clock. He dressed at once and went out with him. It was a lovely fresh morning. Tiny flecked clouds stood overhead like fleecy lambs in the clear blue sky. Fine dewdrops lay on the leaves and grass, sparkling like silver on the spider's webs. The damp, dark earth seemed still to preserve the rosy traces of the dawn. The songs of larks poured down from all over the sky. Bazarov walked as far as the plantation, sat down in the shade at its edge, and only then disclosed to Pyotr the nature of the service he expected from him. The cultured valet was mortally alarmed, but Bazarov quieted him down by the assurance that he would have nothing to do except to stand at a distance and look on, and that he would not incur any sort of responsibility. "And besides," he added, "only think what an important part you have to play." Pyotr threw up his hands, cast down his eyes, and leaned against a birch tree, looking green with terror. The road from Marino skirted the plantation. A light dust lay on it, untouched by wheel or foot since the previous day. Bazarov found himself staring along this road, picking and chewing a piece of grass, and he kept on repeating to himself, "What a piece of idiocy!" The morning chill made him shiver twice. Pyotr looked at him dismally, but Bazarov only smiled. He was not frightened. The tramp of horses' hoofs could be heard coming along the road. A peasant came into sight from behind the trees. He was driving before him two horses hobbled together, and as he passed Bazarov, he looked at him rather strangely, without removing his cap, which evidently disturbed Pyotr as an unlucky omen. "There's someone else up early, too," thought Bazarov, "but he at least has got up for work, while we..." "It seems the gentleman is coming," whispered Pyotr suddenly. Bazarov raised his head and caught sight of Pavel Petrovich. Dressed in a light checked coat and snow-white trousers, he was walking quickly along the road. Under his arm he carried a box wrapped in green cloth. "Excuse me, I think I have kept you waiting," he said, bowing first to Bazarov and then to Pyotr, whom he treated respectfully at that moment as representing some kind of second. "I did not want to wake up my man." "It doesn't matter," said Bazarov. "We've only just arrived ourselves."
"Ah, so much the better."
Pavel Petrovich looked around.
"There's no one in sight, no one to interfere with us. We can proceed?"
"Let us proceed."
"You don't demand any more explanations, I suppose?"
"No, I don't."
"Would you like to load?"
inquired Pavel Petrovich, taking the pistols out of the box.
"No, you load, and I will measure out the paces. My legs are longer," added Bazarov with a smile.
"One, two, three..."
"Evgeny Vasilich,"
stammered Pyotr with difficulty. He was trembling as if he had fever.
"Say what you like, but I am going farther off."
"Four, five..." "All right, move away, my good fellow. You can even stand behind a tree and stop up your ears. Only don't shut your eyes.
and if anyone falls, run and pick him up. 6, 7, 8.
Bazarov stopped.
Is that enough? He asked, turning to Pavel Petrovich. Or shall I add 2 paces more?
As you like, replied the latter, pressing the second bullet into the barrel.
Well, we'll make 2 paces more.
Bazarov drew a line on the ground with the toe of his boot.
There's the barrier. By the way, how many paces may each of us go back from the barrier? That's an important question, too. It was not discussed yesterday.
I suppose 10, replied Pavel Petrovich, handing Bazarov both pistols.
Will you be so good as to choose?
I will be so good. But you must admit, Pavel Petrovich, that our duel is unusual to the point of absurdity. Only look at the face of our second.
You are disposed to laugh at everything, answered Pavel Petrovich.
I don't deny the strangeness of our duel, but I think it is my duty to warn you that I intend to fight seriously.
A bon entendeur, salut!
Oh, I don't doubt that we've made up our minds to do away with each other. But why not laugh and unite util dulci?
So you can talk to me in French and I'll reply in Latin.
I intend to fight seriously, repeated Pavel Petrovich, and he walked off to his place. Bazarov, on his side, counted off 10 paces from the barrier and stood still.
Are you ready? Asked Pavel Petrovich.
Perfectly.
We can approach each other.
Bazarov moved slowly forward, and Pavel Petrovich walked towards him, his left hand thrust in his pocket, gradually raising the muzzle of his pistol.
He's aiming straight at my nose, thought Bazarov. And how carefully he screws up his eyes, the scoundrel.
Not an agreeable sensation. I'd better look at his watch-chain.
Something whizzed by sharply close to Bazarov's ear, and a shot rang out at that moment.
I heard it, so it must be all right, managed to flash through Bazarov's brain. He took one more step, and without taking aim, pressed the trigger.
Pavel Petrovich swayed slightly and clutched at his thigh.
A thin stream of blood began to trickle down his white trousers.
Bazarov threw his pistol aside and went up to his antagonist.
"Are you wounded?" he asked.
"You had the right to call me up to the barrier," said Pavel Petrovich. "This is a trifle. According to our agreement, each of us has the right to one more shot."
"Well, but excuse me, we'll leave that to another time," answered Bazarov, and caught hold of Pavel Petrovich, who was beginning to turn pale.
"Now I'm no longer a duelist, but a doctor, and first of all I must have a look at your wound. Pyotr, come here, Pyotr. Where have you hidden yourself?"
"What nonsense! I need help from nobody," said Pavel Petrovich jerkily. "And we must, again—"
He tried to pull at his mustache, but his hand failed him. His eyes grew dim, and he fainted.
"Here's a pretty pass, a fainting fit. What next?" Bazarov exclaimed involuntarily, as he laid Pavel Petrovich on the grass.
"Let's see what is wrong." He pulled out a handkerchief, wiped away the blood, and began to feel around the wound.
"The bone's not touched," he muttered through his teeth.
"The bullet didn't go deep. Only one muscle, vastus externus, grazed. He'll be dancing about in 3 weeks.
Fainting. Oh, these nervous people. Fancy what a delicate skin."
"Is he killed?"
whispered the trembling voice of Pyotr behind his back. Bazarov looked around.
"Go for some water, quickly, my good fellow, and he'll outlive you and me yet."
But the perfect servant failed apparently to understand his words, and did not move from the spot. Pavel Petrovich slowly opened his eyes.
"He's dying,"
murmured Pyotr, and started crossing himself.
"You are right. What an idiotic face," remarked the wounded gentleman with a forced smile.
"Go and fetch the water, damn you," shouted Bazarov.
"There's no need. It was a momentary vertigo. Help me to sit up. There, that's right. I only need something to bind up this scratch, and I can reach home on foot, or else you can send for a droshky for me. The duel, if you agree, need not be renewed. You have behaved honorably. Today, take note."
"There's no need to recall the past," answered Bazarov, "and as regards the future, it's not worth breaking your head about that either, for I intend to move off from here immediately. Let me bind up your leg now. Your wound is not dangerous, but it's always better to stop the bleeding. But first I must bring this corpse to his senses." Bazarov shook Pyotr by the collar and sent him off to fetch a droshky.
"Mind you, don't frighten my brother," Pavel Petrovich said to him. "Don't inform him on any account."
Pyotr dashed off, and while he was running for a droshky, the two antagonists sat on the ground in silence. Pavel Petrovich tried not to look at Bazarov. He did not want to be reconciled to him in any case. He felt ashamed of his own arrogance, of his failure. He was ashamed of the whole affair he had arranged, even though he realized it could not have ended more auspiciously.
"At least he won't go on hanging around here," he consoled himself by thinking. "One should be thankful even for that."
The prolonged silence was oppressive and awkward. Both of them felt ill at ease. Each was conscious that the other understood him. For friends, such a feeling is agreeable, but for those who are not friends, it is most unpleasant, especially when it is impossible either to come to an understanding or to separate. "Haven't I bound up your leg too tight?" asked Bazarov at last.
"No, not at all. It's excellent," answered Pavel Petrovich, and added after a pause, "We can't deceive my brother. He will have to be told that we quarreled about politics."
"Very good," said Bazarov. "You can say that I cursed all Anglomaniacs."
"All right. What do you suppose that man thinks about us now?" continued Pavel Petrovich, pointing at the same peasant who had driven the hobbled horses past Bazarov a few minutes before the duel,
and who was now going back again along the same road, and took off his cap at the sight of the masters.
"Who knows him?" answered Bazarov. "Most likely of all, he thinks about nothing."
"The Russian peasant is that mysterious unknown person about whom Mrs. Radcliffe used to say so much. Who can understand him? He doesn't understand himself."
"Ah, so that's what you think,"
Pavel Petrovich began, then suddenly exclaimed,
"Look what your fool of a Pyotr has done. Here's my brother galloping towards us."
Bazarov turned round and saw Nikolai Petrovich sitting in a droshky, his face pale. He jumped out before it had stopped and ran up to his brother.
"What does this mean?" he called out in an agitated voice. "Evgeny Vasilich, what is this?"
"Nothing," answered Pavel Petrovich. "They have alarmed you quite unnecessarily. We had a little dispute, Mr. Bazarov and I, and I have had to pay for it a little."
"But for heaven's sake, what was it all about?"
"How shall I explain? Mr. Bazarov alluded disrespectfully to Sir Robert Peel. I hasten to add that I am the only person to blame in all this, and Mr. Bazarov has behaved honorably. I challenged him."
"But you're covered with blood."
"Well, did you suppose I had water in my veins? But this bloodletting positively does me good. Isn't that so, doctor? Help me to get into the droshky, and don't give way to gloomy thoughts. I shall be quite well tomorrow." "That's it. Excellent. Drive off, coachman."
Nikolai Petrovich followed the droshky on foot.
Bazarov lagged behind.
"I must ask you to look after my brother," Nikolai Petrovich said to him, "until we get another doctor from the town."
Bazarov nodded his head without speaking. An hour later, Pavel Petrovich was already lying in bed, with a skillfully bandaged leg. The whole house was upset. Fenichka felt ill. Nikolai Petrovich was silently wringing his hands, while Pavel Petrovich laughed and joked, especially with Bazarov. He had put on a fine cambric nightshirt, an elegant morning jacket, and a fez. He did not allow the blinds to be drawn down, and humorously complained about the necessity of not being allowed to eat. Towards night, however, he grew feverish. His head ached. The doctor arrived from the town. Nikolai Petrovich would not listen to his brother, nor did Bazarov want him to. He sat the whole day in his room, looking yellow and angry, and only went in to the invalid for as brief a visit as possible. Twice he happened to meet Fenichka, but she shrank away from him in horror. The new doctor advised a cooling diet. He confirmed, however, Bazarov's assurance that there was no danger. Nikolai Petrovich told him that his brother had hurt himself accidentally, to which the doctor replied, but on having 25 silver rubles slipped into his hand on the spot, he remarked, "You don't say so. Well, such things often happen, of course." No one in the house went to bed or undressed. Nikolai Petrovich, from time to time, went in on tiptoe to his brother's room and tiptoed out again. Pavel Petrovich dozed, sighed a little, told his brother in French, "Couchez-vous," and asked for something to drink. Nikolai Petrovich sent Fenichka in to him once with a glass of lemonade. Pavel Petrovich looked at her intently and drank off the glass to the last drop. Towards morning the fever had increased a little. A slight delirium started. At first Pavel Petrovich uttered incoherent words. Then suddenly he opened his eyes, and seeing his brother beside his bed, anxiously leaning over him, he murmured, "Don't you think, Nikolai, Fenichka has something in common with Nelly?"
"What Nelly, Pavel dear?"
"How can you ask that? With Princess R., especially in the upper part of the face. C'est de la même famille."
Nikolai Petrovich made no answer, but inwardly he marveled at the persistent vitality of old passions in a man.
"This is what happens when it comes to the surface," he thought. "Ah, how I love that empty creature," groaned Pavel Petrovich, mournfully clasping his hands behind his head. "I can't bear that any insolent upstart should dare to touch," he muttered a few minutes later.
Nikolai Petrovich only sighed. He never even suspected to whom these words referred. Bazarov came to see him on the following day at 8 o'clock. He had already managed to pack and had set free all his frogs, insects, and birds.
"You have come to say good-bye to me?" said Nikolai Petrovich, getting up to meet him.
"Exactly."
"I understand and fully approve of you. My poor brother is, of course, to blame, but he has been punished for it. He told me that he made it impossible for you to act otherwise. I believe that you could not avoid this duel, which to some extent is explained by the almost constant antagonism of your different points of view." Nikolai Petrovich began to get rather mixed up in his words. "My brother is a man of the old school, hot-tempered and obstinate. Thank God that it has only ended in this way. I have taken all possible precautions to avoid publicity."
"I'll leave you my address in case there's any fuss," said Bazarov casually.
"I hope there will be no fuss, Evgeny Vasilich. I am very sorry that your stay in my house should have come to such an end. It distresses me all the more on account of Arkady's."
"I expect I shall see him," replied Bazarov, in whom every kind of explanation and pronouncement always aroused a feeling of impatience. "In case I don't, may I ask you to say good-bye to him for me, and to accept the expression of my regret?" "And I, too, ask," began Nikolai Petrovitch with a bow. But Bazarov did not wait for him to finish his sentence, and went out of the room. On hearing that Bazarov was going, Pavel Petrovitch expressed a desire to see him, and shook him by the hand. But even then Bazarov remained as cold as ice. He realized that Pavel Petrovitch wanted to display magnanimity. He found no opportunity of saying good-bye to Fenichka. He only exchanged glances with her from the window. Her face struck him by its sad look. "She'll come to grief, probably," he said to himself, "though she may pull through somehow." Pyotr, however, was so overcome that he wept on his shoulder, until Bazarov cooled him down by asking if he had a constant water supply in his eyes. And Dunyasha felt obliged to run away into the plantation to hide her emotion. The originator of all this distress climbed into a country cart, lit a cigar, and when, 3 miles further on at a bend in the road, he saw for the last time the Kirsanovs' farmstead and its new manor house standing together on the skyline, he merely spat and, muttering, "Damned nobleman," wrapped himself more tightly in his cloak. Pavel Petrovitch was soon better, but he had to lie in bed for about a week. He bore his captivity, as he called it, fairly patiently, though he took great trouble over his toilet and had everything scented with eau de cologne. Nikolai Petrovitch read papers to him. Fenichka waited on him as before, brought him soup, lemonade, boiled eggs, and tea. But a secret dread seized her every time she came into his room. Pavel Petrovitch's unexpected action had alarmed everyone in the house, and her most of all. Prokovitch was the only person not troubled by it, and he discoursed on how gentlemen used to fight in his day only with real gentlemen. But such low scoundrels, they would have ordered to be horsewhipped in the stables for their insolence. Fenichka's conscience scarcely reproached her, but she was tormented at times by the thought of the real cause of the quarrel. And Pavel Petrovitch, too, looked at her so strangely, so that even when her back was turned, she felt his eyes fixed on her. She grew thinner from constant inward agitation, and, as it happened, became still more charming. One day, the incident took place in the early morning, Pavel Petrovitch felt better and moved from his bed to the sofa, while Nikolai Petrovitch, having previously made inquiries about his brother's health, went off to the threshing floor. Fenichka brought him a cup of tea, and setting it down on a little table, was about to withdraw. Pavel Petrovitch detained her. "Where are you going in such a hurry, Fedosya Nikolaevna?" he began. "Are you so busy?" "No. Yes, I have to pour out tea."
"Dunyasha will do that without you. Sit down for a little while with an invalid. By the way, I must have a talk with you."
Fenichka sat down on the edge of an armchair without speaking.
"Listen," said Pavel Petrovitch, pulling at his mustache. "I have wanted to ask you for a long time. You seem somehow afraid of me."
"I?"
"Yes, you. You never look at me in the face, as if your conscience were not clear."
Fenichka blushed, but looked up at Pavel Petrovitch. He seemed so strange to her, and her heart began quietly throbbing.
"Surely you have a clear conscience?" he asked her.
"Why should it not be clear?" she whispered.
"Why, indeed? Besides, whom could you have wronged? Me? That is unlikely. Any other people living in the house? That is also a fantastic idea.
could it be my brother? But surely you love him.
I love him.
With your whole soul, with your whole heart?
I love Nikolai Petrovich with my whole heart.
Truly? Look at me, Fenichka. He called her by that name for the first time. You know, it is a great sin to tell lies.
I am not lying, Pavel Petrovich. If I did not love Nikolai Petrovich, there would be no point in my living any longer.
And you will never give him up for anyone else?
For whom else could I give him up?
For whom, indeed? Well, what about that gentleman who has just gone away from here?
Fenichka got up.
My God, Pavel Petrovich, why are you torturing me? What have I done to you? How can you say such things?
Fenichka, said Pavel Petrovich in a sad voice, you know I saw...
What did you see?
Well, there, in the summer house.
Fenichka blushed to the roots of her hair and to her ears.
How can I be blamed for that?
She pronounced with an effort. Pavel Petrovich raised himself up.
You were not to blame? No, not at all?
I love Nikolai Petrovich and no one else in the world, and I shall always love him,
cried Fenichka with sudden force, while sobs rose in her throat.
As for what you saw, I will say in the dreadful day of last judgment that I am innocent of any blame for it, and always was. And I would rather die at once if people can suspect me of any such thing against my benefactor, Nikolai Petrovich.
But here her voice failed, and at the same moment she felt that Pavel Petrovich was seizing and pressing her hand. She looked at him and was almost petrified. He had turned even paler than before. His eyes were shining, and, most surprising of all, one large solitary tear was rolling down his cheek.
"Fenichka," he said in a strange whisper, "love him, love my brother. He is such a good, kind man. Don't give him up for anyone, and don't listen to anyone else's talk. Only think, what can be more terrible than to love and not to be loved in return? Never leave my poor Nikolai."
Fenichka's eyes were dry, and her fright had vanished, so great was her amazement. But what were her feelings when Pavel Petrovich of all people, pressed her hand to his lips, and seemed to pierce into it without kissing it, only breathing convulsively from time to time?
"Good heavens," she thought. "Is he suffering from some attack?"
At that moment his whole ruined life stirred within him. The staircase creaked under rapidly approaching footsteps. He pushed her away from him and let his head drop back on the pillow. The door opened, and Nikolai Petrovich came in, looking cheerful, fresh, and ruddy. Mitya, just as fresh and rosy as his father, with nothing but his little shirt on, was frisking about in his arms, snatching with bare little toes at the buttons of his rough country coat. Fenichka simply flung herself upon him, and clasping him and her son together in her arms, dropped her head on his shoulder. Nikolai Petrovich was astonished. Fenichka, so shy and modest, never demonstrated her feelings for him in front of a third person.
"What's the matter?"
he said, and glancing at his brother, he handed Mitya to her.
"You don't feel worse?"
he asked, going up to Pavel Petrovich, who buried his face in a cambric handkerchief.
"No, not at all. On the contrary, I am much better."
"You shouldn't have been in such a hurry to move to the sofa.
Where are you going?"
added Nikolai Petrovich, turning towards Fenichka. But she had already closed the door behind her.
"I was bringing my young hero in to show you.
He has been crying for his uncle. Why did she carry him off? What's wrong with you, though? Has anything happened between you?"
"Brother," said Pavel Petrovich gravely, "give me your word to carry out my one request."
"What request? Tell me."
"It is very important. It seems to me the whole happiness of your life depends on it. I have been thinking a lot all this time about what I want to say to you now. Brother, do your duty, the duty of an honest and generous man. Put an end to the scandal and the bad example you are setting. You, the best of men."
"What do you mean, Pavel?"
"Marry Fenichka. She loves you. She is the mother of your son."
Nikolai Petrovich moved a step backwards and threw up his hands.
"You say that, Pavel? You, whom I always took for the most relentless opponent of such marriages? You say that? But don't you know that it was only out of respect for you that I have not done what you rightly called my duty?"
"Your respect for me was quite mistaken in this case," said Pavel Petrovich with a weary smile. "I begin to think that Bazarov was right when he accused me of being an aristocratic snob. No, dear brother, let us stop worrying ourselves about the opinion of the outside world. We are elderly, humble people by now. It's high time we laid aside all these empty vanities. We must do our duty, just as you say, and maybe we shall find happiness that way in addition."
Nikolai Petrovich rushed over to embrace his brother.
"You have really opened my eyes," he exclaimed. "I was right in always maintaining that you are the kindest and wisest man in the world, and now I see you are just as reasonable as you are generous-minded."
"Softly, softly," Pavel Petrovich interrupted him. "Don't knock the leg of your reasonable brother who at close on 50 has been fighting a duel like a young lieutenant. So, then, the matter is settled. Fenichka is to be my belle sœur."
"My darling Pavel, but what will Arkady say?"
"Arkady? He'll be enthusiastic, of course. Marriage is not a principle for him, but on the other hand, his sentiment of equality will be gratified." "Yes, and after all, what is the good of caste diversions, au dix neuvième siècle?" "Ah, Pavel, Pavel, let me kiss you once more. Don't be afraid, I'll be careful."
The two brothers embraced each other.
"What do you think? Shouldn't you tell her straight away what you intend to do?"
"Why should we hurry?" answered Nikolai Petrovich. "Did you have a conversation with her?"
"A conversation? Between us? Quelle idée!"
"Well, that's all right. First of all, you must get well. It won't run away from us, and meanwhile we must think it over and consider."
"But surely you have made up your mind?"
"Of course I have. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. I will leave you now. You must rest. Any excitement is bad for you. But we will talk it over another time. Go to sleep, my dear, and God grant you good health."
"Why does he thank me like that?" thought Pavel Petrovich when he was left alone. "As if it did not depend on himself. Then, as soon as he marries, I will go away somewhere, far from here, to Dresden or Florence, and I will live there till I expire."
Pavel Petrovich moistened his forehead with eau de cologne and closed his eyes. Lit up by the brilliant daylight, his beautiful, emaciated head lay on the white pillow like the head of a dead man. And, indeed, he was a dead man. End of chapter 24. Recording by Roger Moline.
Chapter 25 of Fathers and Sons. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Fathers and Sons by Ivan Turgenev. Translated by Richard Hare. Chapter 25. At Nikolsko, Katya and Arkady were sitting in the garden on a turf seat in the shade of a tall ash tree. Fifi had placed herself on the ground near them, giving her long body that graceful curve which is known among sportsmen as the hare's bend. Both Arkady and Katya were silent. He held in his hands a half-open book, while she was picking out of a basket some remaining crumbs of white bread and throwing them to the small family of sparrows, which, with their peculiar cowardly impudence, were chirping and hopping around right up to her feet. A faint breeze, stirring the ash leaves, kept gently moving pale gold patches of sunlight up and down across the shady path and over Fifi's back. An unbroken shadow fell on Arkady and Katya. Only from time to time a bright streak gleamed in her hair. Both were silent, but the way in which they were silent and sitting together indicated a certain confidential friendliness. Each of them seemed not to be thinking of the other, while secretly rejoicing at each other's presence. Their faces, too, had changed since we saw them last. Arkady seemed more composed, and Katya brighter and more self-confident. "Don't you think," began Arkady, "that the ash has been very well named in Russian, Yasen? Not a single other tree is so light and translucently clear, Yasno, against the sky." Katya raised her eyes upwards and murmured, "Yes." And Arkady thought, "Well, she doesn't reproach me for talking poetically." "I don't care for Heine," said Katya, glancing at the book which Arkady held in his hands, "either when he laughs or when he weeps. I like him when he is thoughtful and sad."
"And I like him when he laughs," remarked Arkady. "Those are the relics of your old satirical tendency."
"Relics," thought Arkady. "If Bazarov could have heard that."
"Wait a bit. We shall transform you."
"Who will transform me? You?"
"Who?"
"My sister, Porfiry Platonovitch, whom you've stopped quarreling with. My aunt, whom you escorted to church the day before yesterday."
"Well, I couldn't refuse. But as for Anna Sergeyevna, you remember she agreed with Evgeny in a great many things."
"My sister was under his influence then, just as you were."
"As I was. Have you noticed that I've already shaken off his influence?"
Katya remained silent.
"I know," continued Arkady, "you never liked him."
"I'm unable to judge him."
"Do you know, Katerina Sergeyevna, every time I hear that answer, I don't believe it. There is no one beyond the capacity of judgment of any of us. That is just a pretext for getting out of it."
"Well, I'll tell you then, he is, not because I don't like him, but I feel he is quite alien to me, and I am alien to him. And you, too, are alien to him."
"Why is that?"
"How can I tell you? He's a wild beast, while we are both domestic animals."
"And am I a domestic animal?"
Katya nodded her head. Arkady scratched his ear.
"Listen, Katerina Sergeyevna, surely that is in the nature of an insult."
"Why, would you rather be wild?"
"Not wild, but powerful, energetic."
"It's no good wishing to be that. Your friend, you see, doesn't wish for it, but he has it."
So you suppose he had a great influence on Anna Sergeyevna?"
"Yes.
But no one can keep the upper hand of her for long," added Katya in a low voice.
"Why do you think that?"
"She's very proud. I didn't mean to say that. She values her independence very much."
"Who doesn't value it?" asked Arkady, and the thought flashed through his mind, "What is it for?"
The same thought occurred to Katya. Young people who are friendly and often together constantly find themselves thinking the same thoughts. Arkady smiled, and coming a little closer to Katya, he said in a whisper,
"Confess, you are a little afraid of her."
"Of whom?"
"Of her," repeated Arkady significantly.
"And how about you?"
asked Katya in her turn.
"I am also. Please note I said I am also."
Katya wagged her finger at him threateningly.
"I wonder at that," she began. "My sister has never felt so friendly towards you as just now, much more than when you first came here."
"Fancy that!
And you haven't noticed it? Aren't you glad about it?"
Arkady became thoughtful.
"How have I succeeded in winning Anna Sergeyevna's favor? Could it be because I brought her your mother's letters?"
"Both for that and for other reasons, which I won't tell you."
"Why?"
"I shan't say."
"Oh, I know. You're very obstinate."
"Yes, I am."
"And observant."
Katya cast a sidelong glance at Arkady.
"Perhaps so. Does that annoy you? What are you thinking about?"
"I'm wondering how you have grown to be so observant as you certainly are. You are so shy and distrustful. You keep everyone at a distance."
"I live so much alone. That in itself leads to thoughtfulness."
"But do I keep everyone at a distance?"
Arkady flung a grateful glance at Katya.
"That's all very well," he went on, "but people in your position, I mean with your fortune, seldom possess that gift. It is hard for them, as it is for emperors, to get at the truth."
"But, you see, I am not rich."
Arkady was surprised and did not at once understand Katya.
"Why, as a matter of fact, the property is all her sister's," struck him suddenly. The thought was not disagreeable to him.
"How nicely you said that," he remarked.
"What?"
"You said it nicely, simply, without either being ashamed or making much of it. By the way, I imagine there must always be something special, a kind of pride in the feeling of a person who knows and says that he is poor."
"I have never experienced anything of that sort, thanks to my sister. I referred to my position just now only because it happened to come up in our conversation."
"Well, but you must admit that even you have something of that pride I spoke of just now."
"For instance?"
"For instance, surely you, excuse my question, you wouldn't be willing to marry a rich man?"
"If I loved him very much, no, probably even then I wouldn't marry him."
"There, you see," cried Arkady, and after a moment's pause he added, "And why wouldn't you marry him?"
"Because even in the ballads, unequal matches are always unlucky."
"Perhaps you want to dominate, or—"
"Oh, no! What's the good of that? On the contrary, I'm ready to obey. Only inequality is difficult."
"But to keep one's self-respect and to obey, that I can understand. That is happiness. But a subordinate existence, no, I've had enough of that as it is."
"Had enough of that," repeated Arkady after Katya.
"You're not Anna Sergeyevna's sister for nothing. You're just as independent as she is, but you're more reserved. I'm sure you would never be the first to express your feelings, however strong or sacred."
"Well, what would you expect?" asked Katya.
"You are equally intelligent. You have as much character, if not more, than she."
"Don't compare me with my sister, please," interrupted Katya hurriedly. "It puts me too much at a disadvantage. You seem to forget that my sister is beautiful and clever, and you in particular, Arkady Nikolaitch, ought not to say such things, and with such a serious face, too."
"What does that mean, you in particular? And what makes you conclude that I'm joking?"
"Of course you're joking."
"Do you think so? But what if I'm convinced of what I say? If I find that, I've not even put it strongly enough?"
"I don't understand you."
"Really? Well, now I see that I certainly overestimated your powers of observation."
"How is that?"
Arkady made no answer and turned away, but Katya searched for a few more crumbs in the basket and began throwing them to the sparrows. But she moved her arm too vigorously, and the birds flew away without stopping to pick them up.
"Katerina Sergeyevna," began Arkady suddenly, "it is probably a matter of indifference to you, but you should know I would not exchange you, neither for your sister nor for anyone else in the world."
He got up and walked quickly away, as if he were frightened by the words which had burst from his lips. Katya let her two hands drop together with the basket onto her knees, and with bowed head she gazed for some time after Arkady. Gradually a crimson flush spread a little to her cheeks, but her lips did not smile, and her dark eyes had a look of perplexity and of some other still undefined feeling.
"Are you alone?"
sounded the voice of Anna Sergeyevna, quite close to her.
"I thought you came into the garden with Arkady."
Katya slowly raised her eyes to her sister. Elegantly, almost elaborately dressed, she was standing on the path and tickling Fifi's ears with the tip of her parasol, and slowly answered,
"I'm alone."
"So I see," answered the other sister with a laugh. "I suppose he has gone back to his room."
"Yes."
"Were you reading together?"
"Yes."
Anna Sergeyevna took Katya under the chin and raised her face.
"You didn't quarrel, I hope?"
"No,"
said Katya, quietly moving away her sister's hand.
"How solemnly you answer. I thought I should find him here and was going to suggest a walk with him. He keeps on asking me about it. They have brought your new shoes from the town. Go and try them on. I noticed yesterday that your old ones are quite worn out. Really, you don't pay enough attention to these things. But all the same, you've got such lovely little feet. And your hands are good, only rather large. So you must make the most of your feet. But you're not a flirt."
Anna Sergeyevna went farther down the path, her beautiful dress rustling slightly as she walked. Katya rose from the bench, and taking Heine with her, also went off, only not to try on the new shoes.
"Lovely little feet,"
she thought, as she slowly and lightly mounted the stone steps of the terrace, which were burning from the heat of the sun.
"Lovely little feet, you call them. Well, he shall be at my feet."
But a feeling of shame came across her at once, and she ran swiftly upstairs. Arkady was going along the passage to his room when he was overtaken by the butler, who announced that Mr. Bazarov was sitting in his room.
"Evgeny," muttered Arkady in a startled tone.
"Has he been here long?" "He has arrived only this minute, and gave orders not to be announced to Anna Sergeyevna, but to be shown straight up to you."
"Can any misfortune have happened at home?" thought Arkady, and running hurriedly up the stairs, he opened the door at once. The sight of Bazarov immediately reassured him,
though a more experienced eye would probably have discerned signs of inward excitement in the sunken but still energetic face of the unexpected visitor. With a dusty cloak over his shoulders and a cap on his head, he was sitting by the window. He did not even get up when Arkady flung himself on his neck with loud exclamations.
"Well, how unexpected! What good luck has brought you?" he kept on repeating, bustling about the room like someone who both imagines and wants to show that he is pleased. "I suppose everything is all right at home. They're all well, aren't they?"
"Everything is all right there, but not everyone is well," said Bazarov. "But don't go on chattering. Get them to bring me some kvass. Sit down and listen to what I'm going to tell you, in a few, but I hope fairly vigorous sentences." Arkady kept quiet while Bazarov told him about his duel with Pavel Petrovich. Arkady was greatly surprised and even upset, but he did not think it necessary to show this. He asked only whether his uncle's wound was really not serious, and on receiving the reply that it was, most interesting though not from a medical point of view, he gave a forced smile, but he felt sick at heart, and somehow ashamed. Bazarov seemed to understand him.
"Yes, brother," he said, "you see what comes of living with feudal people. One becomes feudal oneself, and takes part in knightly tournaments." "Well, so I set off for my father's place," Bazarov concluded, "and on the way I turned in here, to tell you all this, I should say, if I didn't think it a useless and stupid lie. No, I turned in here, the devil knows why. You see, it's sometimes a good thing for a man to take himself by the scruff of the neck and pull himself away, like a radish out of its bed. That's what I've just done. But I wanted to take one more look at what I've parted company with, at the bed where I've been sitting."
"I hope that those words don't apply to me," retorted Arkady excitedly. "I hope you don't think of parting from me." Bazarov looked at him intently. His eyes were almost piercing.
"Would that upset you so much? It strikes me that you have parted from me already. You look so fresh and smart. Your affairs with Anna Sergeyevna must be proceeding very well." "What do you mean by my affairs with Anna Sergeyevna?" "Why, didn't you come here from the town on her account, my little bird? By the way, how are those Sunday schools getting on? Do you mean to tell me you're not in love with her? Or have you already reached the stage of being bashful about it?" "Evgeny, you know I've always been frank with you. I can assure you, I swear to you, you're making a mistake." "A new story," remarked Bazarov under his breath. "But you needn't get agitated about it, for it's a matter of complete indifference to me. A romantic would say, 'I feel that our roads are beginning to branch out in different directions,' but I will simply say that we're tired of each other." "Evgeny!" "There's no harm in that, my good soul. One gets tired of plenty of other things in the world. And now I think we'd better say good-bye. Ever since I've been here, I've felt so disgusting, as if I'd been reading a Gogol's letter to the wife of the governor of Kaluga. By the way, I didn't tell them to unharness the horses." "Good heavens! That's impossible!" "And why?" "I say nothing of myself, but it would be the height of discourtesy to Anna Sergeyevna, who will certainly want to see you." "Well, you're mistaken there." "On the contrary, I'm convinced that I'm right," retorted Arkady. "And what are you pretending for? For that matter, haven't you come here because of her?" "That might even be true, but you're mistaken all the same."
But Arkady was right. Anna Sergeyevna wanted to see Bazarov, and sent a message to him to that effect through the butler. Bazarov changed his clothes before he went to her. It turned out that he had packed his new suit in such a way as to be able to take it out easily. Madame Odintsov received him, not in the room where he had so unexpectedly declared his love to her, but in the drawing-room. She held her fingertips out to him amiably, but her face showed signs of involuntary tension.
"Anna Sergeyevna," Bazarov hastened to say, "first of all, I must set your mind at rest. Before you stands a simple mortal who came to his senses long ago and hopes that other people, too, have forgotten his follies. I am going away for a long time, and though I'm by no means a soft creature, I should be sorry to carry away with me the thought that you remember me with abhorrence." Anna Sergeyevna gave a deep sigh, like one who has just climbed to the top of a high mountain, and her face lit up with a smile. She held out her hand to Bazarov a second time and responded to his pressure. "Let bygones be bygones," she said. "All the more so, since, to say what is on my conscience, I was also to blame then, either for flirting or for something else. In a word, let us be friends as we were before. The other was a dream, wasn't it? And who remembers dreams?"
"Who remembers them? And, besides, love, surely it's an imaginary feeling."
"Indeed, I'm very pleased to hear that." Anna Sergeyevna expressed herself thus, and so did Bazarov. They both thought they were speaking the truth. Was the truth, the whole truth, to be found in their words? They themselves did not know, much less could the author. But a conversation ensued between them, just as if they believed one another completely. Anna Sergeyevna asked Bazarov, among other things, what he had been doing at the Kirsanovs. He was on the point of telling her about his duel with Pavel Petrovich, but he checked himself with the thought that she might suppose he was trying to make himself interesting, and answered that he had been working the whole time. "And I," observed Anna Sergeyevna, "had a fit of depression to start with. Goodness knows why. I even planned to go abroad. Just fancy. But that passed off. Your friend Arkady Nikolaitch arrived, and I settled down to my routine again, to my proper function."
"And what is that function, may I ask?"
"To be an aunt, guardian, mother, call it what you like. Incidentally, do you know I used not to understand before your close friendship with Arkady Nikolaitch? I found him rather insignificant. But now I have got to know him better, and I recognize his intelligence. But he is young, so young, it's a great thing. Not like you and me, Evgeny Vasilich."
"Is he still shy in your presence?" asked Bazarov.
"But was he..." began Anna Sergeyevna, and after a short pause she went on, "He has grown more trustful now. He talks to me. Formerly he used to avoid me, though, as a matter of fact, I didn't seek his society either. He is more Katya's friend."
Bazarov felt vexed. "A woman can't help being a hypocrite," he thought. "You say he used to avoid you," he said aloud with a cold smile. "But probably it's no secret to you that he was in love with you."
"What? He too?"
ejaculated Anna Sergeyevna.
"He too," repeated Bazarov with a submissive bow.
"Can it be that you didn't know it, and that I've told you something new?"
Anna Sergeyevna lowered her eyes. "You are mistaken, Evgeny Vasilich."
"I don't think so. But perhaps I ought not to have mentioned it. And don't you try to fool me any more," he added to himself.
"Why not mention it? But I imagine that here as well you attach too much importance to a transitory impression. I begin to suspect that you are inclined to exaggerate."
"'We had better not talk about that, Anna Sergeyevna.'
"'And why?'
she replied, but herself diverted the conversation into another channel. She still felt ill at ease with Bazarov, though she had both told and assured herself that everything was forgotten. While exchanging the simplest remarks with him, even when she joked with him, she was conscious of an embarrassed fear. Thus do people on a steamer at sea talk and laugh carelessly, for all the world as if they were on dry land. But the moment there is some hitch, if the smallest sign appears of something unusual, there emerges at once on every face an expression of peculiar alarm, revealing the constant awareness of constant danger. Anna Sergeyevna's conversation with Bazarov did not last long. She began to be absorbed in her own thoughts, to answer absent-mindedly, and ended by suggesting that they should go into the hall, where they found the princess and Katya.
"'But where is Arkady Nikolaitch?' asked the hostess, and on hearing that he had not been seen for more than an hour, she sent someone to look for him. He was not found at once. He had hidden himself away in the wildest part of the garden, and with his chin propped on his folded hands, he was sitting wrapped in thought. His thoughts were deep and serious, but not mournful. He knew that Anna Sergeyevna was sitting alone with Bazarov, and he felt no jealousy as he had before. On the contrary, his face slowly brightened. It seemed as if he was at once wondering and rejoicing and deciding to do something. End of chapter 25. Recording by Roger Moline.
Big news! Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is here. It's Black Friday in July. Right now, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair. Get our lowest prices of the summer for 5 days only. Plus, amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals with fast and free shipping site-wide. So don't wait. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 80% off now through July 28th.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.